come in. Please come in. Please be seated. Well, we have a full house today. It's nice to see you all here on this bright December day. You will notice before we begin that Justice Annette Ziegler, who generally sits to the right of Justice Abrahamson, at least as I'm looking out, is to the right. She is not participating in this case, so her chair is empty and she will not be participating at any point in time. We do have some students with us today, and my notes tell me that Germantown High School is here, and if you are, will you all please stand? Oh, wow. Wonderful. Well, you may be seated. The students are here on a program called Court with Class that we operate in coordination with the State Bar. So they've had the opportunity to learn a little bit about the case that you're going to argue to us throughout this next hour. If you can return, students, when the second case of the morning is over, Justice Rebecca Dallet will come down and chat with you a little bit about how cases get to the Supreme Court and how they proceed. So, and anybody else who would like to attend can, of course, also attend as well. So, with those brief announcements in mind, I will call our first case of the morning. Oh, we have a little bit of a different lineup. So before we begin, just so I'm sure I'm on the same page that you all are on, Attorney Leavell, you will have 25 minutes. And then Attorney Coberly, you will have 15 minutes. And Attorney Pillmaker, you will have 15. And then we return to you, Attorney Leavell, for another 5 minutes in rebuttal. We're all on the same page? Okay, that's super. Okay, the first case of the morning, West Bend Mutual Insurance Company versus, Ixthus Medical Supply Company. Are you prepared to begin, counsel?
I am. May it please the court, Madam Chief Justice and Justices, it's my pleasure to be here. My name is Jeff Leavell. I represent West Bend Mutual Insurance Company in this matter. Also with me is a fairly recent associate, Austin Borton, assisting in the case. It's our pleasure to be here today. I come to address four specific points that are outlined in the briefs already before the court, but I also want to address any questions you have, and I appreciate the give and take of being peppered with questions, and I invite that. The four central topics I suggest I address are, first, advertising injury and the causal connection. Secondly, the knowing violation of rights exclusion. Thirdly, the criminal acts exclusion. And fourth and last, public policy and fortuity that are involved in this case. So with that, our first point, it's our fervent belief and argued in the briefs that there is no advertising causal connection to injury here involving Ixthus. No advertising activity by Ixthus caused injury to Abbott. Ixthus imported and distributed, not sold or advertised. Before the court is the complaint from the Eastern District of New York, the second amended complaint. It is found at, starting in our appendix at page A49, the complaint describes a story and must be read as a whole to understand exactly the underlying factual basis for the claims against Ixthus and, for that matter, many other parties in this case. Our adversaries in the appeal argue that the complaint alleges advertising activity relying on two specific paragraphs, paragraphs 15 and 385 in this second amended complaint. But well preceding those complaint paragraphs are specifics that tell a very important story. And I don't intend to quote all of them, but I think a passage, an excerpt from paragraph 7 of the second amended complaint is telling. And midway through that paragraph, the complaint alleges, quote, the distributor defendants, that's Ixthus, and pharmacy defendants have a long-standing relationship through which they agreed to purchase diverted freestyle test strips from foreign countries at these lower prices and then dispense them to consumers at higher U.S. retail prices for the purpose of receiving fraudulent reimbursement payments from the consumers' insurers.
Counsel, the first issue that you talked about was the causal connection between advertising injury and or advertising and the injury that's claimed. And you say that the complaint is insufficient. But I look at paragraph 6 of the complaint. It says these false submissions caused and continue to cause Abbott to pay out wrongfully millions of dollars in rebates. Why isn't that a statement of a causal connection?
Because the false submissions are actually reimbursement requests that are made after the purchase of the product, long past the advertising of the product to the consumer.
But the paragraph to me says it was the advertising that caused the rebates, and the rebates were an injury. So I don't understand there's a lack of causal connection. I didn't understand your argument well in the brief, and I have the complaint, which I've read and marked, and I still don't understand it.
If I could try to clarify our position, looking specifically at paragraph 6 in which you pointed out, the decision to submit a falsified reimbursement claim is a decision that happens post-purchase. It's a decision that's not compelled by advertising. It could be done at any point. It could not be done without regard to advertising. So, for example, the test strip could have been sold buying low in the international market, selling high in the domestic market, and no reimbursement submission ever made. The reimbursement submission is not alleged to be a part of the advertising activity.
It's alleged to be an effect of the advertising injury, and I thought you were talking about a causal connection between the claimed false advertising or dilution of trade dress, which is kind of what they're talking about, and the injury to Abbott. I don't think they have to occur at the same time. To me, cause is a cause and effect. I mean, if you have an effect, then you got cause. An effect of the advertising injury they're saying is these rebates, which were caused by the advertising injury. I'm having a hard time with that.
I understand. And maybe by looking at the policy language, that would be...
Okay, I have that, too. Tell me what you'd like to look at.
I'm looking at particularly appendix pages 44 and 46 of our brief. 46 is the entry point to personal and advertising injury, and it describes an offense that's arguably at issue here. That's in paragraph G, infringing upon another's copyright, trade dress, or slogan in your advertisement.
Right.
And advertisement is in quotes.
Right.
So that word in quotes is defined later in the policy. It's actually earlier on the appendix page, A44. And there, advertisement is described as a notice that is broadcast or published to the general public or specific market segments about your goods for the purpose of attracting customers or supporters. And I would submit to you that there's nothing about the reimbursement claim submission that is driven by an advertisement to the general public or specific marketplace.
Isn't packaging an advertising as well,
right,
Counsel?
It is. And
doesn't packaging cover that?
Well, but it's not Ixthus. It's not Ixthus is packaging. It's Ixthus buying the packaging that was created by Abbott and selling it in a marketplace that was not
intended. The middle person can't be connected. It had to have come from the person who actually packaged it?
Well, the policy language does say in your advertisement, and the your is defined to mean the policy holder, the named insurer. That would be Ixthus. It's really the advertisement of Abbott that's involved in the packaging. I agree with you. Packaging is an advertisement, and I think even in Ross Glove, the court described that as the advertising instrument. But that's Abbott's advertisement, not Ixthus.
And so their distribution of it in a way that allegedly harms Abbott's, their quality and control, and their what people expect from Abbott in terms of that quality, you're saying a distributor can't be causally connected to that?
Well, only because it's not the distributor's advertisement, nor is it their notice to the general public. The distributor sends it to a pharmacy defendant, and the pharmacy defendant then does the advertising to the consumer.
Counsel, if the if Ixodus had taken a photograph of the box and submitted that along with the product, would the photograph constitute advertising of Ixodus?
I think you're definitely getting closer. That's obviously not alleged in the Second Amendment complaint, but that invokes the activity of Ixodus in the process of the advertising.
So let's look at how specific the complaint needs to be to allege a causal connection, because all we're looking for is an allegation of a causal connection, right? As opposed to an actual connection.
It's a duty to defend analysis, so it's an allegation that asserts the liability of the policy.
So let's take a look at paragraph 15. I'm going to read that with significant elisions to make sure that we don't spend the rest of your time reading it. It says, defendant's advertisement causes consumer confusion, mistake, and deception to the detriment of Abbott. The advertisement of diverted international freestyle test strips caused great damage to Abbott and the goodwill of Abbott's valuable trademarks, and that is defendants, plural, correct?
That's correct.
All right. In that term, that when that complaint refers to defendants, plural, that includes Ixodus.
Yeah? It does. Okay. It does.
So it is alleging that Ixodus advertised. That's the allegation.
If one cherry picks paragraph 15 out, yes.
And I am cherry picking that right now. So let's focus on that. If paragraph 15 was the only paragraph in the complaint that referred to the defendant's advertisements, would that be a sufficient allegation of a causal connection between advertisement and injury?
It could be.
Okay. So is it your position, then, that the addition of other paragraphs in the complaint detract from the sufficiency of paragraph 15?
I wouldn't use the word detract. I think it's judgment laden. I think they clarify the story. And I would point to, for example, paragraph 389 in the amended complaint graphically depicts this relationship. It shows a chart and it's of this illegal scheme. In fact, it's subtitled Illegal Distribution Chain.
Mm-hmm.
And it shows the distributor defendants far removed from the consumer. And,
right.
And the goodwill injury that Abbott is describing is a goodwill it feels it has with the consumer that might be offended by its purchase of the international package in the domestic market.
Yeah. Do any of the other paragraphs in this very long complaint specifically say that Ixodus did not do any advertising?
Yeah, I think there are numerous paragraphs that either say it or imply it, and I would start with paragraphs 4, 5, and 7 of the Second Amended Complaint. They describe the role of the distributor in the illegal scheme.
Right, but did they affirmatively state that they did no advertising?
No, I don't think that's specifically alleged.
So is there anything in the rest of the complaint? Let me start over. So complaint paragraph 15 specifically says the defendants did advertise, and that includes Ixodus.
It does.
Okay. And nothing else in the complaint specifically says they didn't.
Well, I would say to you the illegal distribution chain figure at page paragraph 389 shows that the distributor defendants are not in the process of advertising to consumers. The graphic shows pharmacy defendants with an arrow directly to consumer.
Right. So clearly the drafter of the complaint believes that is, at that point at least, that's the important thing to concentrate on. But does that necessarily mean that when they said in paragraph 15 that Ixodus did advertise, that it's a contradiction?
Well, I think it's a combination of the graphic and the preceding paragraphs in the complaint that describe the role of distributor defendants and distinguish it from pharmacy defendants.
Okay. So let's say we put all of that together, the graph, the other paragraphs. Are you saying that all of that together contradicts the allegation in paragraph 15?
It doesn't contradict it. It clarifies it. It shows that, and maybe it does in a way, implicitly contradict
it. Well, I think you need to tell me yes, it does? Because paragraph 15 says that Ixodus advertised.
Well, I would submit that the complaint has to be read as a whole. The complaint tells a story, and the first several hundred paragraphs tell a fairly specific story about this illegal scheme and the roles of distributors versus pharmacy defendants.
Right. So let's. So would it be inconsistent with the balance of the complaints if Ixtus, in fact, was also doing advertising?
Yes, I think so, because the advertising is defined by the policy and by Fireman's Fund as a notice to the public.
So, Mr. Lavelle, in the short time that you have, can we move to the second issue, which I think is the one, at least I don't want to speak for my colleagues, but that is more, I think there's more dispute about potentially, which is the knowing violation exception and whether that applies.
Yes, I would like to do that. Again, this is a duty to defend analysis. It's a four corners test. So we're looking at the allegations of the complaint. And again, there are many references throughout here, but paragraph 7 of this complaint is illustrative of how the distributor defendants and the pharmacy defendants have had a long-standing relationship. The graphic that I pointed out earlier, found at appendix page 89, paragraph 389 of the second amended complaint, shows that this is an illegal distribution scheme. In effect, if West Bend has to insure this, it has to insure an illegal, unlawful distribution scheme. So the knowingness is actually conceded by Abbott in its brief at page 35, where Abbott says, to be sure, the complaint alleges that Ixtus did know, and did is in bold.
Right, but isn't the question whether or not they still have a duty to defend based on the fact that there are claims in this complaint, more than one, for which there is no intent that needs to be proven at all. So let's say we get to a jury, and a jury finds a violation of the Lanham Act and finds that there wasn't intentional conduct. You're saying Weston didn't have a duty to defend along the way because the word knowing or the intent was actually pled as part of the complaint?
Our argument, and it's specifically air engineering might be a pressure point for this argument, is that the analysis that looks at the elements necessary to prove a claim and deduces from them whether or not intent has to be proven is backwards. It perverts the four corners test, which is that the court must look at the allegations first and decide whether the allegations describe a covered claim. So, for example, in this case, my opponents are really asking the court to conduct a hypothetical, and really claims adjusters at insurance companies, to do a hypothetical analysis of an allegation and ignore the actual facts alleged. And this I see argued at Abbott's brief at page 29, where Abbott says, quote, it simply requires hypothesizing that not all of the allegations may ultimately be proven, close quote. So who is to do this hypothesizing? Claims adjusters, courts? The beauty of the four corners rule is it looks to the allegations of the complaint, doesn't call upon, as the court said in Waterwell, people to imagine allegations that aren't made. It looks to the allegations to see what's the result of that, often couched in, if proven, what would happen?
Counsel, though, the duty to defend, from which we to which we apply the four corners rule, is broader than actual coverage. And so if there are any claims that are made, even though some for which you would not have to have coverage, if there are any potential claims that coverage would apply to, then you have to defend the whole complaint. So you can argue that some parts of the complaint sound like intentional conduct, but if other parts of the claims made stand up without the knowing violation concern that you've discussed with Justice Dallet, then West Bend has to defend the whole complaint.
If one can isolate a claim, I certainly agree. Our position, and I submit to you, Your Honor, that this complaint tells an incredibly long story, not only calling it an illegal distribution scheme, it also alleges that Ixtus, under a prior name, got in trouble, got enjoined, changed its name and found a new victim, and then went after that new victim, and then when it got subpoenaed for information, took the Fifth Amendment. So clearly, this very long story shows that it was knowingly violating rights.
I think you can argue that, and I understand why you do, but I also have to tell you, I think there are parts of the complaint that state claims that require no intent.
Counsel, could I perhaps walk you through how this might work out in practice? And I think this might get to the Chief Justice's concern as well. Do you agree that there are causes of action alleged in this complaint that could be successfully pursued without any allegation of intent?
Not against Ixis, and I'll tell you why. Because the illegal distribution screen illegal distribution scheme graphic shows how Ixthus participated in this. Without Ixthus's participation in this illegal scheme, there could be no claim against him.
Well, except, I mean, there's a Lanham Act claim, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Unfair comp and trade dress.
And that does not require proof of intentional conduct, does it?
No, just looking at the law, it does not.
Okay. So if we just look at the law, there are several causes of action included in the complaint that do not require intent to be successful, correct?
If you just look at the label of the cause of action or claim,
yeah,
that's true.
All right. So let's walk down the road of what might happen in real life. So let's say that West Bend is excused. We say, yes, you have no duty to defend here because every allegation of action is an intentional action. Yeah? And we say, no duty to defend. You get your judgment. You walk away. Ixthus then goes to trial. And let's say they're incapable of proving intent, or Abbott is incapable of proving intent against Ixthus. But there is recovery. So the jury says, yeah, no intent, but there was a Lanham Act violation, so you're liable, right? Let's say that happens. What is Ixthus to do at that point? Can they come back to West Bend and say, oh, by the way, I know you got your judgment on the basis that the complaint was pled as an intentional violation, but we just got pinged with damages based on unintentional violations of what was alleged in the complaint. What happens then?
I have a couple different answers to that, if you bear with me. First is, it's a hypothetical not before. It's not fully briefed. And I urge the court
that's what we do here.
I understand. I urge the court not to go down that rabbit hole. But
oh, you opened up the invitation saying, I love questions.
Yeah. Well, I do.
Careful what you ask for.
And I have thought about that question. That's not a question I didn't anticipate. Mm-hmm. And so what happens is several things. First of all, when the case goes to trial, it's supposed to stay between the lines. The lines of any case that go to trial are the lines established by the pleading. And the pleading for liability against Ixthus is that it was a criminal involved in this unlawful scheme. And if the plaintiff is able to somehow pull it out of the scheme and find a benign, non-criminal predicate for liability, it's nowhere alleged in this pleading.
Okay, let me just stop you right there. So I'm not sure that the trial always has to stay within the lines of the pleadings. You know, we have this mechanism by which you can actually amend the pleadings after trial to conform to the evidence.
That's certainly in the rules. I can tell you I've been trying cases for over three decades, and I've never seen that happen. I know it's there. It's a hypothetical possibility, but it's an extremely rare bird.
Yeah. So do you have any authority with you that says you cannot submit anything to the jury that is not pled in the pleadings?
I would start with the rules of evidence, materiality, the 90403 weighing that must occur in any case. Evidence that I submit outside the lines is going to almost by definition confuse the jury.
Would the judge instruct the jury that even though a Lanham Act violation does not require intentional activity, you may not find liability unless you find intentional actions on the part of Ixthus? Would the judge instruct that?
We're kind of way down a hypothetical. My suspicion is not, because it sounds like the judge is instructing the jury about the legal effect of its fact-finding, which more commonly doesn't happen. I don't think the judge would instruct that.
I don't think he would either. But doesn't that then create the possibility for a verdict against Ixthus that has nothing to do with intentional activity based on the complaint as it is currently pled?
I find it hard to answer that, and here's why. Without this illegal scheme, Ixtus isn't a defendant. There is no benign theory of Lanham Act recovery for non-knowing passing or trade dress violation or unfair comp that bears any relationship to the facts alleged. All of these facts are all about, in fact, the complaint footnotes it, a federal statute out of 18 U.S.C. that was violated in this illegal scheme.
So would it be your position that Ixtus could successfully move for summary judgment if Abbott does not come up with any proof of intentionality?
Yes. Because it would be rebutting this allegation that it participated in a legal scheme if it could somehow establish that it was not. But again, we're way down the rabbit hole. We look at the complaint, the allegations that are in it, the allegations of the illegal scheme, the allegations of the Fifth Amendment invocation, the allegations that this isn't their first time around the bush. They did this under the name Milwaukee Notions just a few years before they did this. This is all about an illegal scheme, and it's the kind of thing that is only actionable because they knowingly violated a right. I should continue. I don't hear questions. But on this issue of the knowing rights violation exclusion, what the Court of Appeals did here was look at the necessary elements of the claim and said if those necessary elements were proved, a liability would be established, and then jumped to its conclusion about whether there was a duty to defend. It didn't bother itself with the fact allegations of the complaint that show that illegal scheme. For that very same reason, I submit to you, this criminal acts exclusion is also applicable to this because, again, it's a criminal act. It's an illegal scheme that's alleged. That's the gut.
You're saying if it's alleged, isn't there some dispute as to whether you'd actually have to have a conviction or at the very least some kind of indictment for that action? And the case law seems to support that.
I'm glad you raised that. The very first case cited by Abbott in its brief in support of that proposition is out of the Seventh Circuit. I think it's called Allstate versus Brown, and it doesn't say that at all. I read it again last night. Allstate versus Brown addresses a shooting that involved the invocation of the criminal acts exclusion when a civil claim had been brought about by the shooting. The decision says, yes, the shooter got convicted, but the decision doesn't say the conviction was what made that exclusion applicable. It said the conduct, the criminal conduct, and that's consistent with the plain language of this exclusion. This exclusion does not require a criminal conviction. It's not a criminal conviction exclusion. It's a criminal act exclusion, and for good reason. The exclusion shouldn't depend upon whether or not prosecutorial discretion was exercised to pursue the criminal and get a conviction.
Is there any support for that in any case where you have a situation where someone has not even been charged with a crime and the courts have said the criminal acts exclusion applies?
I don't think there's a Wisconsin decision on this.
Even in other jurisdictions, the cases that were cited to us seem to have at least a charge of criminal conduct.
Well, the fact of the charging of criminal conduct concurrent with the act doesn't mean charging or conviction is a necessary predicate for the exclusion to apply. The plain language, you know, this court's long pronouncements about plain language ought to govern here. I see my red lights on, but that's what we look to is the plain language, particularly because there's very little Wisconsin decisional law on it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
My name is Jason Pillmeyer, and I am proud to appear on behalf of Ixtus Medical Supply and Carl Kunstmann. I am also here to introduce attorney Linda Koberly of the firm of Winston & Strong. She's admitted in Illinois, and she has admitted Prohoc V.J. in Wisconsin.
Thank you. Have you been admitted Prohoc V.J. on this particular case?
Yes, I have.
Okay, very good. Please proceed.
Good morning, and may it please the court. I'm Linda Koberly. I represent Abbott, the Abbott respondents in this case, and I am grateful for the opportunity to appear here in Wisconsin. I'm happy to take any of your questions, but I'm going to start, if it's all right with the court, where we spent most of our time, which is on the knowing violation exclusion. And Mr. Pillmeyer will be speaking as well on behalf of ICSPIS. The insurer here took a very disfavored and high-risk approach. It unilaterally refused to defend the insured while it litigated this declaratory judgment action. The New York action is proceeding, and West Bend is not defending. It sued both ICSPIS and Abbott in Wisconsin for a declaratory judgment of no duty to defend and no duty to indemnify, and that's what brings us here today. Now, with respect to the knowing violation exclusion, the Court of Appeals applied a very clear rule of law based on established Court of Appeals precedent, which is that at the pleading stage, allegations of willful conduct don't trigger a knowing violation exclusion if the insured could be held liable without them. That's a clear and sensible rule. It's the law in a majority of jurisdictions. It's consistent with this court's decision, and there's no reason to set it aside. Now, in this case, it's important to note that this is a, it's obviously, you've seen it, it's a very complex complaint. It's against
counsel,
110 defendants.
Counsel, would that rule always mean that the knowing violation exclusion could not be the basis for denying a defense?
No.
Under what circumstances could an insurance company invoke the knowing violation exclusion to deny a defense if we are to always disregard allegations of intentionality in measuring the duty to defend?
Well, our argument is not that you always disregard allegations of intentionality. The argument is that you have to look at each claim individually through the lens of the elements required for liability, just as courts do all the time in evaluating a motion to dismiss, for example.
So we look at not at the factual allegations. We look at the textbook definition of a cause of action. Is that what you're saying?
I'm saying you have to start with the elements. And we get that idea all the way back to Fireman's Fund.
And if we start with those elements and we find that they do not require intentional activity, do we also end there?
Yes, I think you do. I think you do, because the mere presence of an allegation of willfulness, it's there here, for example, because of a separate request for enhanced damages and attorney's
fees. Okay. So the only time that the knowing violation exclusion could excuse an insurance company from the duty to defend under your rule would be when the elements of every cause of action alleged in the complaint require an intentionality element.
I think the answer is yes, and let me explain why. This is different from the knowing violation exclusion is different from, for example, the question whether there's been an accident or occurrence, which is what many of these courts, this court's cases deal with. In fact, most of the cases that West Bend cites are actually accident or occurrence cases. And they're different because we're not talking about an intentional acts exclusion, and we're also not talking about whether the underlying event was an accident or was foreseeable or something like that. We're talking about a very specific exclusion that excludes coverage for injury, quote, caused by or at the direction of the insured with knowledge that the act would violate the rights of another and would inflict the injury. So it's a knowledge that is directed very much at the violation itself. It's not I took an act volitionally. It's not the underlying thing that caused the injury was a surprise to me because it involves somebody punching somebody in the face, which is the case in a number of this court's cases. I think of them as the punch-in-the-face cases,
yeah.
Right?
Effectively, doesn't the complaint allege that ICSPIS punched Abbott in the face?
No, it does not, Your Honor. It alleges a scheme by 110 different defendants, and it alleges a series of different causes of action. There was a claim for RICO conspiracy. That claim has been dismissed, and we all agree about that. Mm-hmm. So the claims alleged in the complaint are against a number of different people who play different roles in a series of events. ICSPIS is alleged to be a distributor. It is not alleged to have diverted itself any strips from overseas. It is not alleged to have obtained any fraudulent rebates. And there's some confusion in the briefing about that. West Bend's brief actually says that ICSPIS received rebates. That's not alleged in the complaint. And you can see from that graphic, it's the insurance companies that get the rebates. It's not the distributors. Nothing about that graphic that my colleague directed you to depends on Ixthus knowing that there was something going on. Ixthus simply acquired strips that had been diverted by somebody else, advertised its ability and willingness to sell them. It had advertised that to the marketplace, which includes its own customers, which are pharmacies. And it sold the strips that it had.
What was the nature of the advertising?
The allegation in the complaint is that the advertising was through websites, trade shows, etc. The allegation is that the advertising was to the marketplace and through packaging, and you know, that's what you identified earlier, the paragraph that makes those allegations. And the result of that was a series of injuries that relate to the fact that people thought, including pharmacies, thought they were buying U.S. test strips when in fact they were buying test strips that were packaged for sale elsewhere. And in paragraph 15 of the complaint, this causes or is likely to cause consumer confusion, mistake, and deception to the detriment of Abbott, including, according to paragraph 15, great damage and harm to Abbott and the goodwill of Abbott's trademarks, and paragraph 567, a loss of sales and or market share. Because every time Abbott, every time Ixthus sold a box of non-U.S. strips that Abbott had sold at a much lower price overseas for a variety of reasons, that's one less box that Abbott could sell in the United States of U.S. packaged test strips, which it sells for a higher price, in part because down the road somebody might get a rebate. So there's a direct connection between the impression Ixthus and other defendants are alleged to have created about what they were selling and their ability to sell U.S. test strips and the damages alleged in the complaint. So the role Abbott, the role Ixthus played and its liability within this overall story, as my colleague pointed out, is actually much narrower. And that's why it's so important, particularly in a case where you're talking about multiple claims and multiple defendants, to examine the duty to defend from the perspective of each individual claim against the insured in particular. So it is not the case that West Bend is being asked to insure against the sum total of the extensive complaint with hundreds and hundreds of paragraphs. West Bend was retained and paid to insure Ixthus against liability for advertising conduct that causes advertising injury. And that is exactly what Ixthus's liability would be here. And this court's cases make very clear that the duty to defend is to be broader than the duty to indemnify. And if you can imagine how this case might play out, there is an allegation of willfulness, and we know why. As the court observed in Ross Glove, the Court of Appeals observed in Ross Glove, under the Lanham Act, you can allege willfulness as a way to get enhanced damages or attorney's fees. But the liability for the Lanham Act violation does not depend on that finding of willfulness. So I disagree with my colleague about whether Ixthus could seek summary judgment because of a failure to elicit proof of Ixthus's knowledge. The claim doesn't depend on Ixthus's knowledge. It simply depends on the conduct that's alleged, in the infringement conduct and the injury. It's a strict liability claim. But imagine how this would play out. We get down the road and discovery, supposed discovery, disproves the allegation of willfulness. Suppose that allegation is no longer pursued in the case. I don't think anyone would need to amend the complaint to remove it. It would simply not be litigated. It would not be presented to the jury. And then there very well could be a finding of liability in this case against Ixthus without any finding that Ixthus's violation was known. And that can't be the way the duty to defend works. It has to be broader. This court observed in Fireman's Fund, paragraph 39, that the pleading rules permit inconsistent theories. In fact, in federal court in particular, under the federal court's now enhanced pleading standards under the Iqbal and Twombly cases, you have to plead quite a lot in federal court to get past a motion to dismiss. And so you put in all potential facts that you can plead in good faith. But not all of those claims, those allegations, succeed. And as this Court observed in Fireman's Fund, it is not essential that all the allegations be construed harmoniously.
Counsel, what is your best argument about why ICSIS conduct falls within Section 5 definitions of advertiser and advertising? I don't know what your appendix. I have the one on the red book. It's the appendix I have, and it's on page 44, but it's Section 4 under definitions in the insurance policy.
Well, the advertising includes trade dress, and the allegation in the complaint is that the defendants, including all the defendants, advertise through websites, trade shows, et cetera, their ability to sell and willingness to sell international test strips. So that's the factual allegation.
Okay.
And I'm in a unique position because I'm not actually handling the New York action, so I, too, am bound by the complaint, and that's it's kind of handy for purposes of this conversation. I'm looking at the allegations in the complaint, and they say that the defendants, including ICSIS, advertised using websites and trade shows, et cetera.
What did they display in the advertisement? I guess that's
what the complaint does not say. The complaint does not say, and yet this claim survived. I mean, it's continuing in the case. It's an allegation in the complaint that there was advertising. And in order to investigate exactly what was advertised, et cetera, we would need to look at extrinsic evidence, which we don't look at for purposes of the duty to defend. So particularly where the duty to defend has been violated because they refuse to defend and are instead litigating. So based on the face of the complaint, which is what we have to look at, there is an allegation that there was advertising. In fact, I don't believe there's any dispute that there was advertising. And I don't believe there's any dispute that there was injury. The dispute and the litigation in this case has been about the causal connection element, not about whether there was advertising. So as far as the knowledge element and what is possible under the complaint, there's lots of possibilities. It's possible that ICSIS was negligent or mistaken about the strip's origin. It's possible that it was unaware about the material differences. It's possible that it was unaware it was violating Abbott's rights. I'm not suggesting the court should speculate about any of that or should assume any of that is true. But what we do know is that the complaint doesn't require a conclusion otherwise. There is an allegation that ICSIS engaged in misconduct earlier under a different name. That is true. That's alleged in the complaint. But the allegation is different. The allegation is that ICSIS sold strips that were counterfeit, actually, not that they were imported or diverted or mislabeled or anything like that. It suggests that they were counterfeit. I don't know what that means exactly, but it doesn't establish knowledge of this violation for which ICSIS may well be held liable in this case.
So, counsel, if you are successful in proving everything in your complaint against ICSIS, will there be insurance coverage?
If we are successful in proving that ICSIS willfully violated, then we would get enhanced damages, and those enhanced damages at least would not be covered.
And would anything be covered? If the proof is that ICSIS acted willfully and intentionally and knowingly violated Abbott's rights, any insurance coverage?
I think it would be difficult to say there would be insurance coverage. I think there would not be.
So for you to get, you're obviously here arguing that West Bend should be providing the duty to defend, and presumably at some point you would argue that they should indemnify as well.
We actually have already argued that, and the Court of Appeals in its remand said there should be a judgment. That was a cross motion.
Yeah.
That's not before this court.
Yeah. So, but as a practical matter, in the underlying case, you can be successful in getting West Bend to defend only if you are unsuccessful in proving your allegations of willfulness.
We could get West Bend to indemnify if we are unsuccessful
Right.
They need to defend either way, because it's possible that that there could be liability here without a finding of knowing violation.
Right. So we would have to discount the allegations of willfulness to find a duty to defend.
You don't need to discount them. You just need to accept the fact that claims are pleaded in the alternative. Mm-hmm. Pleadings are broader than what ultimately happens in the litigation, that not every factual allegation is necessary to every claim. In fact, if you look at the individual factual allegations in this case, or in the individual claims in this case, many of them, including deceptive business practices under the common law unfair competition, and those two in particular, contain no allegations of willfulness. And the plaintiffs West Bend doesn't say they contain allegations of willfulness. All they do is include a boilerplate paragraph that says we incorporate everything that happened before, like virtually every complaint did.
Thank you,
thank
counsel.
You very much.
Mm-hmm. Good morning again. Jason Pillmayer on behalf of Ixthus and Carl Kunstman.
Could you move the microphone up? Your voice is quite soft, so make the microphone.
Sorry about that.
This room is a terrible room to hear. Thank you.
I'd like to pick up where we left off on the causation issue, if I may. The discussion when West Bend was discussing this focused on the rebates, but there's other injuries alleged by Abbott in the complaint based on the advertising. And those injuries include consumer confusion, the loss of goodwill, loss of sales, market share. All of those things Abbott alleges were caused by the advertising.
And when we refer to consumer in that context, is that referring to the end user of the product or your customers?
I believe it refers to the end user. And I'm glad you asked that, because I want to clarify another issue that came up. When we're discussing the boxes, yes, these are Abbott's boxes, but the policy defines your product. It means any goods or products other than real property manufactured, sold, handled, distributed, or disposed of by you. So for the purposes of the policy, the box is handled and sold by Ixthus, so it's Ixthus's product. And therefore, it's Ixthus's product which caused the confusion. Because at many points in the complaint, it says that the defendants, it doesn't define defendants everywhere as distributor or pharmacist. Many times it just says defendants, which includes Ixthus here. And the defendants' advertising and sale caused the consumer confusion. Additionally, the complaint, with regard to those boxes, it alleges that they contain material differences which render them confusing. And those material differences include different testing sites, different languages. So what Abbott is alleging is that the consumer goes to the pharmacy, picks up a box, and when they view that box, it tarnishes Abbott's brand because they don't understand what it's saying to them. Finally, this didn't come up in the prior discussion. However, the complaint also alleges the entry of an injunction in the underlying case, the New York case. And the court in Acuity versus Bagadia said that when there's an injunction entered, a federal court can't do that without a likelihood of success on the merits, on the claim. And here the complaint alleges a likelihood of success, or it alleges the entry of the injunction in the New York case, which indicates a likelihood of success on the trademark cause of action. I would like to also address the fact that West Bend argues that the sale to pharmacies somehow severed the causation issue here, that West Bend didn't sell to consumers. Well, the allegation in the complaint does say defendants sold to consumers. So I don't think there's a break in the causation. Even if you disregard that, the case in Ross Glove sold to Cabela's, and Cabela's sold to the consumer. And there wasn't a causation issue there, a break in the chain. Additionally, the boxes remain consistent throughout, the alleged misbranded boxes. One note I would like to add with regard to the knowing violation exclusion. It was sort of touched on, but I think it's worth addressing a little more, and that's the idea that complaints may be pled inconsistently. In addition to Fireman's Fund, Doyle also addressed this. And in Doyle, said that reliance upon allegations in other counts alleging intentional conduct is an opposite, as parties are allowed to plead in the alternative. Also, in Waterwell, the court pointed to this language, which I think is important with regard to this case. Often a plaintiff will file a complaint that alleges both negligence and intentional conduct. With this allegation of negligence, the insurance company will have a duty to defend. If the plaintiff stands fast on an intentional act or nothing position, there is no coverage, nor is there a duty to defend or indemnify. And here Abbott's not standing fast to an intentional act or nothing position. They are, we discussed the issue that may arise on summary judgment. Well, there is a summary judgment going on right now. And one of the issues is intent.
And counsel, is it your position that you can prevail in the motion for summary judgment if Abbott is not able to produce any evidence of intentionality?
Can you say the first part again?
Right. So is it your position that Ixthus can prevail on the motion for summary judgment if Abbott is not able to produce any evidence of intentionality?
It can prevail on a portion of the summary judgment if Abbott's unable to prove intentionality. And that portion would be that Abbott's not entitled to the enhanced damages. One additional item with regard to the pleading. There's an argument in West Bend's brief that discusses, well, because every allegation is incorporated into every cause of action, that somehow means intent applies to everything. If we look at where they state the actual causes of action, there's an ambiguity there in the pleading. For claims 1, 2, 11, and 12, Abbott realleges everything prior, but they also specifically allege intent. And under all the other claims, 3, 4, 5, 6, and 13, Abbott doesn't realledge intent. So I would argue the way that we look at the Four Corners rule in Wisconsin and the duty to defend and the insured getting the inferences, the reasonable inferences, that the inference may be there, that this ambiguity in the complaint weighs in favor of, it's possible that those claims 3, 4, 5, and 6, they don't require intent, and Abbott is not seeking intent. It just so happens that those involve causes of action that don't have treble damages or enhanced damages too.
Is there any part of the complaint that describes Ixthus's actions that does not describe it as being knowing or intentional?
There are. There
such
are
as?
Number, excuse me?
Such as. And in particular, are those allegations sufficient to support the causes of action that do not require intent?
They are. For instance, in paragraph 15, which is separate from paragraphs alleging intent, says that the defendant's unauthorized importation, advertisement, and subsequent distribution causes or is likely to cause consumer confusion, mistake, and deception to the detriment of Abbott. Doesn't say anything about intent in there. Also, when you get to the complaint later, in paragraph 426, it discusses Ixthus's activity in particular, at least two examples of it, in which Ixthus sold these boxes to a pharmacy. And there it just alleges plain facts. Ixthus sold the box to a pharmacy. It does not allege that Ixthus did that with intent. And if we are looking at the court's recent decision in Talley, where the court said that where you have a negligence claim whose sole source is an intentional act. That's not what we have in this case. We have an act, which was the advertising and sale of a box of diabetic test strips, which may or may not have been done with intent. It's alleged that it is, separately, but it's not alleged that it had to be done with intent.
Well, how did the product get out?
As alleged in the paragraph I was just discussing, Ixthus sold the product to a pharmacy.
Intentionally sold it.
It intentionally sold the product, but not necessarily intentionally to harm Abbott.
Right. That's the difference between an intentional tort and a negligent tort.
Correct.
Intentional tort, I drove the car. I didn't, and I intended to do 80 miles an hour, but I didn't intend to kill him. Right?
Right. I think there's an allegation. The act of selling a box to a pharmacy, yes. He intended to sell a box to a pharmacy, I would argue, to make a profit.
Sure.
Not to harm Abbott.
Okay.
Yeah.
Where does it get you in this case?
In this case, I think the knowing acts exclusion requires you that not only you intend to do the act, but that you intend to harm. And if Ixthus didn't intend to harm, which is likely under the facts pled in the complaint, I don't think the knowing acts exclusion applies. Additionally, I think in the Marks versus Houston case, the court mentioned that when you're looking at these exclusions, criminal acts exclusion, knowing acts exclusion, there's a reason most of these cases are decided when there are facts, when it's not at the duty to defend stage, and that's because you want to find out if there actually was a criminal act, not just that someone alleges one. And overall, I think our position, at least with causation and the duty to defend, is that the cases over and over again talk about, at the duty to defend stage, you're looking at the possibility of coverage. Is it possible that Ixthus could be held liable without a showing of intent? And I would argue, with the complaint we have, absolutely it's possible. And one thing that wasn't mentioned, this court has previously said that the intentional acts exclusion is interpreted narrowly. So I think all those factors together show that it's at least too early to talk about the exclusion. We can talk about the exclusions, but to apply it in this case, especially when there are causes of action that survive without a proof, showing of intent. That's all I need to cover.
Thank you very much. Rebuttal.
Thank you again. I appreciate the opportunity for short rebuttal. And to do that, first, a couple of things. In response to Abbott's assertion that the complaint doesn't allege who received the rebates, I would refer the court to paragraph 4 of the Second Amendment complaint that says quite concisely, quote, the defendants, plural, are passing these unapproved test strips off to unsuspecting U.S. consumers to receive insurance reimbursements that they are not entitled to, period, close quote. In response to Justice Kelly's question, while we're looking at the Second Amendment complaint, counsel for Ixthus asserted that paragraph 15 described an offense that lacked the criminal intent or the knowing violation here. And the only way to read paragraph 15 when it says, quote, the diverted in international freestyle test strips, close quote, is to understand that phrase is referencing the illegal scheme depicted graphically in the complaint and otherwise described in the complaint. Does the phrase knowing violation appear in paragraph 15? No. But that's the only way to understand that shorthand reference to the diverted international test strips is that it contemplates that sort of thing.
Counsel, we've been...
I'm sorry. No, go you go ahead. That's fine.
We've been talking a lot about intentionality, and I think we need to tie it back to what the policy says. The policy speaks to a knowing violation of the rights of others, so it's only knowing. I mean, they may know that they were diverting from the international market to the domestic market, but they have to have knowledge that the act would violate the rights of another and would inflict personal and advertising injury. Where are you reading that into the complaint with respect to the trade infringement sorts of claims in the complaint?
Well, in the sense that the trade dress allegation rests upon package, a package that's Abbott's. And so Abbott's contention here is that through this international illegal scheme that ICSTHUS is profiting first when it buys internationally low and sells high because it's selling a package that is advertising language that's appropriate for the international market but doesn't contain the FDA-approved language necessary for the domestic market. And that packaging is the supposed advertising instrument that's referenced here.
But how does that suggest that they would have knowledge of violating the rights of others and injuring, specifically personal and advertising injury, that it would inflict that type of injury?
Because the allegations in paragraphs 4, 5, and 7 in the graphic depict how you would the only way one could buy internationally low and bring it here to sell domestically high to profit off it would be to know you were profiting off of it. And to know you were profiting off of it, it meant somebody had to lose in the deal, and that somebody was Abbott. That's the gravamen of the complaint here. And then the loss is compounded post-consumer purchase when the rebate's applied for, because the party paying the rebate based upon this packaged material is Abbott. So there's a double whammy, a loss of sorts that occurs to Abbott that could only have happened by a purposeful plan. There's no reading of this complaint that would suggest that ICSTHUS was mistakenly or accidentally buying internationally and selling domestically and encouraging the receipt of unpermitted rebates, reimbursements.
Is there a reading of the complaint that would allow for that they did not intentionally cause confusion? They, of course, intentionally made the purchase internationally, but that the distribution did not, there's no showing of intent to cause confusion?
Yeah, I submit there it's all intentional confusion because the confusion is the U.S. consumer paying a domestic U.S. price for a cheaper international test strip and package surrounding it. So the customer's confused at the buy stage when it pays an inflated price for what it could have gotten internationally a lot lower if it was a sophisticated buyer of
product. And the allegation then is that there is a loss of market share as a result of this confusion?
Right, exactly. And you heard Abbott's counsel talk about it, that in effect, one of the results of this scheme is buyers in the United States are buying these test strips that ICSTHUS has brought over here, and as a consequence, they don't buy in the domestic market from what Abbott has distributed to pharmacies. And that's another intended consequence of the illegal scheme. All of this would have to be intended. ICSTHUS obviously does it because it's profitable. That's why they do it. It's not an unknowing, benign kind of offense. And I submit to you that, I see my red light.
It is on.
Can I continue?
You can conclude with a quick sentence. Thank you.
That's the analogy we draw to Ross Glove and American Engineering, where there the offense was the Lanham Act violation. There was an add-on upon information and belief about reckless disregard and willfulness that was added as almost an afterthought, if you will, in a pleading that distinguishes those cases from this case.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you for fine arguments. And the briefs were really, really quite good on all sides. So it's a big help to the court when counsel does extra homework for us. And so it's a very interesting case, and we thank you for your presentation today as well. The court's going to take a brief recess so the students that are now with us can leave. others can come in and counsel can come in for the second argument. So we are adjourned.